what we did, what was a very clever idea, is we built native on top of the IAB display specification. So we found a way to hack the display pipes of the programmatic infrastructure to transact non-display banner ads.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name out there.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Ad Tech. I'm Marty Kine.
And I'm Jill Royce, and we are the hosts of this podcast that looks at the first two decades of advertising and marketing technology.
From DoubleClick to DoubleVerify and everything in between.
Get your name out there.
This week, we're very happy to welcome Ari Lewine to the program. Ari is co-founder, along with Eric Berry and Sean Zakaria, of a company called Triple Lift. Triple Lift provides the leading platform to help advertisers and publishers do native advertising. And native advertising is basically advertising that blends in a little bit better with its environment, kind of like ads on Facebook and Instagram. The company was founded in 2012 and sold a majority stake to Vista Equity earlier this year for a reported $1.4 billion, or approximately 3 NFT.
When you were a little Ari out there in the world, did you have a vision for yourself? Did you have sort of a dream career or anything you thought you saw yourself turning into?
Oh yeah, from a very young age, my dream was to be a brain surgeon. And on my first biology test, I got a D. And I subsequently found out that a single D precludes you from actually basically becoming a doctor.
You're out!
Were you an entrepreneurial child? Did you have a lemonade stand?
So my parents are both entrepreneurs. My entire experience is watching them work on various businesses, some very successful and others less so. And I've been involved in all those businesses, sometimes as a kid just on roller skates being around their office, which was in our basement, or sometimes like in the case of high school where I was actively involved doing sales and helping set up computers for their various businesses. And so the notion that was a path available to me was very clear from a very young age. And
so what was their most successful venture? Was it in technology?
No, it wasn't. The most successful one of my parents was selling neckties to department stores. And what they did is they would license the art rights to beautiful pieces of art and print that on ties back when people wore ties in the 80s and 90s.
You ended up at AppNexus. How did you get there?
My first job at a school was at a startup called Oyster.com, which was doing hotel reviews. And I was 20 years old. They had me doing all sorts of random jobs, from booking photographers to go into hotels to take photographs and to figure out ways to generate bookings on the site so you can get nights at a hotel. And at some point they had me figuring out how to make money for them. And I had no idea what that meant. And someone suggested one way we can make money is ads. And so I started figuring out how to sell ads. And after about 3 or 4 months, I started hearing this word called programmatic all the time. This was in 2010. I went out to lunch one day with a friend of mine, and he said, "I just joined a job at a company that does programmatic." And I said, "Which one?" And he said, "AppNexus." And this was a name I kept hearing over and over again of a company that I should work with to help monetize Oyster.com. And so I said, "This is clearly the future. Everyone is telling me that ads are going to be automated and data-driven, and this company appears to be at the intersection of it." And at that time, to give you a sense, AppNexus was 50 people.
Yeah, so very early, right? This is just post-Right Media.
That's right. There was no information even on the website or anything. You couldn't find out. I remember as part of my interview process, I had to create a sales pitch for the final round. This was long before the AppNexus or Xandr that we know today. The idea, I think, was to just be a sort of a cloud computing platform for ad tech companies, not necessarily a marketplace to transact.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Competing with AWS and GCP eventually, but they pivoted intelligently. So how did your pitch go?
I took a leave from my previous job to work on this presentation that I had to give, that my sort of like my whole nascent career was riding on. And I had no information, so it was incredibly difficult. And I get there and about 15 people pile into the conference room to hear me pitch their product to them for a company that has no information on their website. And the TV doesn't work. And I'm freaking out because I spent all this time on this beautiful PowerPoint and I want to be able to present it. And I was fortunate that my brother-in-law, who's in the printing business, had a courier and delivered a printed version. And I handed out the printed version. And the moment I handed out the printed version of my deck, people were so impressed that I took the time and energy to print it out and bind it beautifully.
Was it couriered in during the meeting or was it ready before?
Right before, on my way into the AppNexus offices, this is in Flatiron, New York City on 18th and Broadway, a courier met me as I walked in and I said, I don't need it. He said, just in case. So it turned out that I don't know
Genius. How
he could possibly know that, but it was the perfect thing at the perfect time. And I don't know, had that not happened, I'm not exactly sure, you know, which way my life would have gone.
So what did you do at AppNexus?
I was hired as an account manager. And at that time, the business was really focused on servicing ad networks. And many of those ad networks were Israeli. And I spoke a bit of Hebrew. And so as time went on, I sort of became the default Israeli ad network guy at AppNexus. I learned a ton because these Israeli ad networks at the time were among the most clever, pioneering companies that were innovating at the highest levels. And so I was able to basically soak up what was going on like a sponge because I had the benefit of learning everything about programmatic from AppNexus and everything about the broader media industry from these Israeli ad networks. You know, these names aren't around anymore, but it was Ybrandt and DSNR Media Group. These were some of the names. At that time in 2010, these were the largest sort of brokerage houses of ads on the entire internet in terms of volume.
So at some point, you identified an opportunity that led to Triple Lifts, the native ad opportunity. What was that? What was the kind of germ, the inspiration, the moment?
So I have two co-founders, Sean and Eric, who I met at AppNexus. And we met because we joined AppNexus at around the same time. And we worked together on some pieces of business. And we just had a great deal of mutual respect for one another. And so we got to talking as coworkers and friends do. And a lot of stuff just didn't make sense to us. You know, who's clicking on all these banner ads? Nobody. I've never clicked on a banner. My friends have and my family. But yet, you know, the system is showing all these clicks. And man, we're spending a lot on developing cutting edge technology on how ads are transacted more efficiently. But what about the ads themselves? Like, this is still the same ad as 1994. It's like still a 720x90. Like, can't we be doing better? And so it seemed to me the industry was heading in a very curious direction to us, which is investing solely in transaction and back in infrastructure and very little into the thing that we were very excited about, which is how do you create actually a better ad? Mm-hmm. And specifically, how do you create a better ad for people? You know, when you say, which ads do you like? A common refrain I hear is the ads on Instagram. Those are native ads, but you don't have those Instagram ad experiences elsewhere. And so our idea was, let's create these consumer-friendly ads that are beautiful, that work better everywhere. And in order to do that, we had to build a lot of technology that was never built before. We had to develop computer vision suite to look at brands' images. We had to create dynamic templating technology that lives on the publisher's page and could basically read the design of the publisher, and to essentially turn a single set of assets from a brand into 20,000 unique native ads and do it in milliseconds to be synergistic with the programmatic ecosystem. And that's the technology we started developing when we left AppNexus together in 2012.
Get your name out there.
So way back in 2012, you're sitting down, you have a vision for a better ad experience that you run up against. Obviously, you're aware of IAB standards, so standard banner sizes, 300x250, et cetera. How did you consider that? Did that seem to be a roadblock? Did you feel you could work with those sizes?
So we did not wait for industry standards. We find that the best way is just to innovate and let the industry standards come to you, not the other way around. Meaning let marketers speak with their dollars, let publishers speak with their content inventory. What we did, what was a very clever idea is we built native on top of the IAB display specification. So we found a way to hack the display pipes of the programmatic infrastructure to transact non-display banner ads. And so we built a translation tool that we called the Wizard, which was a way to basically create a native ad, but but run it in a DSP as if it's a 300 by 250. So the DSP at that time thought it was a 300 by 250. In the publisher system, it would be in their reporting, it would say 300 by 250, but the ad would be a beautiful native ad that was custom to that specific publisher. And so that's how we got started.
Were you inspired by social networks and the way the social experience, like on a Facebook or Instagram?
Very much so. And when we started, the word native was just starting to be talked about. I believe the person who's credited for coining it is Fred Wilson, who's a prominent venture capitalist. And he was referring to his investments in social networks like Twitter and Tumblr. To your point, social networks were using native as the de facto ad experience. They weren't taking on banner ads. A big catalyst for our growth early on was that there was a, you know, many listeners may remember there was a Facebook product called Facebook Exchange or FBX, which was Facebook's only foray into making their ad inventory available programmatically. And it was tremendously successful as far as programmatic was concerned. It was enormous scale. It was super cheap. It worked really, really well. And then suddenly at around 2015, Facebook shut down the program. And there was no access to social anymore in the programmatic ecosystem. And that was the exact time that we launched the industry's first native programmatic platform. And so the timing could not have been more perfect because we went to every major marketer and ad agency and said, the same stuff you're running on Facebook now, you can run programmatically on the open web. You'll still have social-like ad experiences available to you. So you're not going to be able to reallocate those FBX budgets to Triplelift. And that pitch worked really well during that period of time where marketers and their agencies were scrambling for a new solution, given that so much of their ad inventory had just dried up overnight.
That was a big decision on Facebook's part. I know if you want to know more about it, you can read Chaos Monkeys, which takes you through that story. Very dramatic ups and downs. So you left AppNexus before you had raised money, kind of pre-seed, or had you already kind of lined up some money?
There was not even the idea when we left AppNexus. I think there was a lot of admiration and respect between Sean, Eric, and I. And we joined an accelerator called ERA, which was based in Times Square and was really challenging because that accelerator had businesses had been around. The word is accelerator, which means you have a business to accelerate.
Gentlemen, start your engines.
All of our peers, you know, there's like 10 businesses in that class, and all of them had customers and product and revenue. And we were just pivoting different ideas one after the other. It didn't start, we did not have this beautifully formed idea one day of we're gonna build the world's first native programmatic exchange and expand it to CTV. We had all sorts of ideas. The major idea that we actually raised money on originally was to be an enterprise platform for brands to market themselves on Pinterest. And it may be hard to remember now, but back in 2012, Pinterest was the single fastest growing website ever. It was growing faster than Facebook in its heyday. And so there was no, every brand was figuring out, what can I do with this fast growing, exciting visual platform? And there was nothing you could do. And so we said, we're gonna solve for this. But we pivoted out of that when we realized, man, it is real risky to build your whole business off a platform like Pinterest when they won't even respond to our emails or phone calls. I don't know if this makes sense. But that's when we went back to our roots in ad tech.
Were most of your ideas around the ad business, or did you go farther afield than that?
We, you know, so Sean and Eric had ideas prior to my involvement that were around marketplaces, like alternatives to Craigslist. So the notion of instead of putting in a product and people browsing like you would on Craigslist, you could match people intelligently. Like, so you, Marty, can say all the things that you're in market for and interested in buying. And I, as a seller, can put up all my wares and the system would intelligently match it. You know, we looked at other things. Facebook had interesting products at that time around sharing their social graph. And we were experimenting with different tool sets you can do to leverage that graph. So, you know, to be honest with you, we were really trying not to do ad tech as hard as we could, but then, you know, we just realized there was so much, that's what we knew, and there was so much opportunity.
Yeah. So you had the native idea, you're gonna run with it. Was it hard to raise money and get interest?
No, 2012 is a great time to, in New York City. First of all, the New York City startup scene was really burgeoning at that time. There were all these VCs and investors who were coming into the space. AppNexus as a company was one of the single hottest companies in the New York City tech scene at the time. And nobody was really leaving AppNexus in 2012. It was like one of the fastest growing companies that just raised enormous sums of money with strategic investments from Microsoft. Like the fact that three young up and coming people from the company all left together to do ad tech just was very alluring to investors. So even though we had no reason to raise money from the investors we did, they were just investing in us. And really just the fact that AppNexus specifically was such a hot company that three people leaving from that hot company was enough for them to write a big check. And we raised at the time, you know, seed rounds now are enormous. So everything, the whole world has changed. But back then we raised 1.6 million for a company that was pre-revenue, pre-product, pre-customers, pre-everything was a really, really large round. You know, we started the accelerator was in the winter of 2012 and there was no heat. So we would literally be wearing gloves and jackets in the office. It was the office we were in had no windows because it was covered by a New York Times billboard. So there was no light, there was no heat. It was hard to type because your fingers were cold. So we realized we had to get out of there with the money. So we got our first office place, which was in a co-working, an independent, this was before WeWork, so an independent co-working place on 26th Street. And for those of you not in New York City, 26th Street between 5th and 6th is where people sell drugs. So if you want, you know, it was basically a really sketchy area. And in this co-working space, people were just coming and going. You had all sorts of different businesses. Businesses were going under and starting. People were changing desks. And one of our investors sent us each a bottle of Dom Perignon to celebrate the investment. And so we were excited to finally drink it. And when we came back to our desk, it turned out someone had stolen it from a box underneath our desk. And so that was our celebration for our seed round, was really realizing our celebratory champagne was taken from us.
Did you have heat in that office?
We did. We were very pleased. We did not. The biggest issue in that office is that they didn't have cell phone reception. And so we were there trying to close deals and, you know, calls were going in and out and just basic IT stuff was a huge issue. And, you know, it's easy to take this stuff for granted now, but those were like really major problems. You can imagine trying to get a business off the ground, but your internet connection is spotty, your cell phone reception is spotty. Like these were the real things that we were trying to deal with on a day-to-day basis in order to get our business off the ground.
You weren't worrying about the muffins being gluten-free or not, I guess.
No. You know, a few offices later, we had a fridge stocked with kombucha. So things did change pretty quick.
But you were in Silicon Valley, roughly speaking. You're in that region. So who did you first pitch? Was it brands? Was it agencies?
Our first pitch, the first thing we need to do was get publishers.
Yeah.
We need publishers to adopt a never before seen ad format. And so my partner, Sean, and I flew to San Francisco and we met a publisher in a coffee shop. You know, we just literally cold emailed random blogs at that point and said, are you interested in exploring this new native ad format? And by the way, at that time we were calling it organic ads. And then we called it sponsored images because the industry had not sort of picked what to call this thing yet. Native had not become a commonplace term. There was like there were no Gartner eMarketer reports on the size of the native ad market. This is like, you know, 2012, 2013, this is pre all of that. And so, you know, we met him, I remember, in a coffee shop inside of a bank, and he had no reason to take the meeting with us other than I think he was just freeing in the area. And he decided to take a leap with us. Even though we didn't have any money to give him, we had no reason. He just thought the ads looked nifty. And it was a one-man website. It is called foodgawker.com was our first ever website. It's a recipe site. And we were thrilled because that was the first time we'd ever pitched him one. And he said, yes. Yeah. So we were batting 1,000. And I was like, wow, this whole business is easy. And then we pitched a marketer and they were like, okay, great. We think these ads look great. How many websites do you have? And we said one, and they laughed and said, come back to us when you have more than one.
Two.
And so that chicken and the egg problem was a really, really big problem to get started, because marketers want scale and they want performance and publishers want money. And on day one, you could provide neither. You have no monetization for publishers and you have no scale for marketers. And so the way we combated that specific issue is our strategy was to go niche by niche, vertical by vertical. So first we started in food. We got foodgawker.com. And that was just, the only reason we started in food is because that was just happened to be our first publisher customer. We said, okay, we have one, let's get five more. And so we started contacting other food and recipe sites. Then we started contacting food advertisers. So our first customer was Chobani. And we gave it free to Chobani just to see how it would work because we didn't even know if it worked. And I remember on the first day, the click-through rate was 0.5%. on that campaign.
That's good.
And I remember when the team had this up and we realized, holy shit, we are onto something here. This is, at the time, the industry standard, you know, click-through rate was something like 0.05. So we were performing 10 10X. Times better. Yeah. And that was sort of one of the most seminal moments of the whole company, because we had spent a couple of years building this technology, trying to get it implemented. And this was the first time we had it live, but no one knew that just because the ad looks better, that it will actually perform better. Mm-hmm. And when it did, it was tremendous validation and just a huge like sigh of relief that all this was, it wasn't for nothing, that we're actually creating something, hopefully of value here. And from there, we got General Mills, and then we expanded into fashion with Victoria's Secret and other fashion blogs. And then eventually, you know, within the year, we were basically in every category and we had every major vertical. And now we work with 100% of the Ad Age 100 and, you know, 85% of the Comscore 200 and almost every market globally. And so it turned out it wasn't just a niche thing, that everyone wants better ad formats. Everyone is looking for a better ad experience.
So you mentioned the wizard. And I think I get how that worked. What, on the publisher side, can you explain how native worked? You analyzed the site and you looked at what the CSS files and DOM or something like that.
That's exactly right. You got it, Marty. So we had a piece of tech that would sit on the publisher that would look at the style sheet of CSS. And for those less technical, that's basically the code that dictates the unique look and feel of the publisher. So the colors, the fonts, the layout. And we were able to look that up and have the native ad placement that we created adopt that CSS and style sheet. And then we would go back and forth with the publisher around specific configurable areas, like what kind of disclosure do you want? Do you want it to say sponsored by, or do you want it to say advertisement by? You know, do you want the text on the left-hand side of the brand's video or image, or on the right-hand side, that kind of thing. And they would integrate our technology. This is before header bidding. So we would have our technology would be tagged on the publisher's page, and they would give us a certain amount of traffic that we would monetize on their behalf. And the pitch really was to publishers, keep everything you're doing. If you're running banner ads and you're running video ads, keep all that. We're just going to give you more money. So if you want to make more money as a publisher, Triplelift has a solution. And as it turns out, that's a really good pitch to publishers. Publishers want more money. And we were able to really have an extraordinarily incredible few number of years where we basically went from having that one site, Food Gawker, to basically getting every major website on the internet in just a small amount of time with basically just that pitch, because we could give you incremental revenue that you can't get anywhere else in the programmatic ecosystem. So the programmatic is filled with all these different exchanges, marketplaces, SSPs. A lot of them are transacting the same demand as one another. It's largely undifferentiated. And so when we came and said, we're going to give you demand that you can't get through any other SSP, no other exchange has the unique dollars that are earmarked specifically for Triplelift.
How did you deal with the sizes? Because I know a lot around ads are on the exact size, but native ads could be any size, really.
It is, if you render a native ad beautifully, like 9 times out of 10, that is thoroughly unacceptable for any major marketer. It needs to be perfect every time. Meaning you can't, like, you know, an example is you can't cut off the model's head in a native ad and expect to ever work with that marketer ever again. So that's why it took us a long time to really get started in the beginning, because we had to basically not just build an entire RTB ad exchange, which is difficult technology in its own right, and integrate with every major DSP, which is really tricky when you're a tiny 15-person company and trying to get Google to integrate. But we also had to build technology that was never built before in the history of ad tech with computer vision. So computer vision basically is this discipline within computer science where you train software to look at images and to try and understand what's in the image. So for instance, is there a human face? Are there objects? What is the focal point of the image? Where is the foreground, midground, and background? Is there text on the image? To basically understand what's called points of saliency. In other words, what's really important in this image that you need to respect? What can't you cut out? And so we had to build this technology and run every single creative that brands upload into our system through this computer vision suite. And then we had to determine for every single publisher, every single placement, can this brand's image look good in this specific placement? For instance, if it's a horizontally oriented brand image, but a vertically oriented publisher placement, it may not just work there. And so we had to build tools and all sorts of logic into our ad exchange that accounted for the fact that not every ad, unlike in display where a 300 by 250 is always going to fit in a 300 by 250 slot, every native ad from an advertiser doesn't fit in every native ad placement from a publisher. And so we built this logic into our exchange that made sure it looked perfect every time. And by the way, there's not going to be any approval, right? When you're dealing with internet scale and thousands of publishers, it's not like we, you know, the brand is going to vet each and every one. They have to trust us. And that was honestly the biggest risk when we started that business model is, are people going to trust us or not?
Did you early on decide to build your own DSP, or were you intending just to integrate with others and then maybe later on build your own? How did that thinking evolve?
So what we realized is we basically needed to build a sufficiently large native ad network to put pressure on DSPs to do the engineering work of creating native ad workflows, to creating a native integration with Triplelift, which was really novel. At that time, most DSPs were just doing banner ads. You know, the DSP ecosystem then, there was mobile-specific DSPs that just did in-app advertising. There was video DSPs and there was display DSPs. It's not like today where every DSP has, you know, full capabilities across every channel. And so what we did is we started by building a native ad network using old school insertion orders and the like to basically prove to marketers and agencies that this is a viable and effective solution. And these budgets in IO started to grow and grow in size such that when we went to the DSP, we said, we do not want to run an ad network at all. We want to give you this business. We want to send and forward this IO to you. And that was necessary because going back to your question earlier about IB standards, we find that the activities of the world's largest marketers and publishers set the standards. And so these DSPs saw that large marketers wanted to buy native ads and they wanted to buy from Triplelift. And so it was incumbent upon them to support the needs of their customers. And that was I mentioned the first big risk of our business was getting marketers to be comfortable with us changing their creative. The second biggest risk was, how are we going to get all the DSPs to build out native integrations and workflows, especially Google with DV360 because of the size of that specific DSP. And we managed to do it by virtue of getting some of the largest Google customers to ask DV360 to do it. And they did. I think at the time, I can't remember if it was DV360 or Invite, right? This was like in around 2014 or 2015 when all this happened.
Yeah, to get them to devote engineering resources to integrating with you. Is it a significant task on the DSP side? Was it to integrate with Triplelift, or did it just require some attention?
So the key, by the way, the other trick that I didn't mention is that wizard tool allowed us to basically start running native demand without the DSP doing much work. So if a DSP simply integrated with Triplelift, but didn't natively support native, if that makes sense, meaning they didn't build a tool set in the DSP UI to upload native assets, we built a way around that with the wizard tool to allow a marketer to run native, even if the DSP didn't technically support native. And that was a tricky period of time, by the way, because when DSP customers asked their DSP, do you do native? They would say, no, we don't have support for native. But at Triplelift, we said, yes, you actually can run native. The DSP may not even be aware of it, but we can assure you we built a way to do it. And so things were hacky at that time, right? This was really early days, and we felt very comfortable in that sort of area. You have to be comfortable with that murkiness. And so that murkiness was the fact that, you know, we wanted to be partners with DSPs, but DSPs, you know, had their own product roadmaps and other things and own processes that it takes time. And so we said, we'll be patient with you. In the meantime, we're going to funnel as much dollars to you as possible to prove how valuable this new market segment is. And that really worked. And that very much speaks to this key thing, which is what matters, you know, what matters to the entrepreneur doesn't really matter to anyone else, right? If Triplelift wants to be successful, Google doesn't care about Triplelift's success. Google cares about whatever its specific objectives are.
Was it a nice moment when AppNexus integrated with you guys?
Their AppNexus was the first integration we did. And that became a bit of a catalyst because we can then go to other DSPs and say, did you know AppNexus has this capability to tap into this, you know, the next big channel in programmatic, which is native, and you don't.
That makes it almost a no-brainer at that point.
I'm not worried that you're crazy anymore. Worried that you're right.
That's right. You know, same thing like with going back to Chobani. You know, Chobani went to Adweek and they wrote an article about it. And then when you have that article, You can go to another large CPG food company and say, have you seen what your competitor Chobani's doing? They found a more effective ad format, and we'd love to see if you have any interest in experimenting with it as well. And essentially the key then becomes is it's so hard to get any amount of momentum going. The whole world is against you. We live in, generally speaking, and even now in ad tech, there's two mentalities. I think there's sometimes a mentality of, oh, you're a scrappy young startup, you're building something exciting, I'll take the chance on you. But generally speaking, I would say it's the opposite. Why take the excess risk on working with an unknown? And at that time, Triplef was an unknown entity. And so by choosing to work with us, in many ways, you were putting your career or reputation at stake. And that was really a hard thing to ask our customers. And we knew that. And so the key was, how do you mitigate that risk, the personal risk of choosing to do the risky thing and choose a startup over an established player? Thank you. And how can we mitigate that by sharing case studies and press to show that this isn't risky, that this does work? And it was incumbent upon us to take every little win and squeeze all the juice out of that. So that, getting Chobani was such a thrill and getting Flugok was such a thrill. How can we take those wins and get 5 more wins out of that and use those 5 to get 5 more wins? Because that's the only way to essentially get to the next level is take every win and see how to leverage it to get to that next stage, to get any degree of momentum started, because that's the major problem that companies like Triplef face in the early days.
And we would like to thank Julia Douglas for letting us use her music, Julia Douglas with 2 S's.com.